I'd like to welcome you all to the first of what I trust will be an indefinitely ongoing series of afternoons with ... held at the behest of the Audio Engineering Society Los Angeles section. My name is Peter Sudheim, and I've been asked to moderate these. As I'm sure you know, this afternoon's guest is Dr. John Frain, who appears to have been active in audio engineering before most of us were born, I think. I hesitate to make exact. I don't know. I mean,
we're not all that young.
What little biographical data I've been able to find talks about the early part of this century, which makes it sound like a terribly long time ago. He is perhaps best known in some circles for as the author of a textbook called simply Sound Recording, I believe. Is that true? That's that one. The book, I think, must be one of the first to have mentioned. To have devoted a chapter or two to magnetic recording from a professional point of view. And I gather it was used as a sort of textbook and was an outgrowth of classes that you taught at UCLA. Dr. Frain, among other things, has received most recently the AES Gold Medal for Outstanding Achievement in Advancing the Art of Audio Engineering in 1978. He was the president of the Society of Motion Picture and Television Engineers in 1955, or was elected in 1955, and was awarded the Progress Gold Medal of the SMPTE in 1952. Among substantive, tangible, palpable contributions to the art, he pioneered the 45-45 stereo disc cutting system developed by Westrex in the 1950s, and gave the first public demonstration of that in 1958. And I gather you were also very much involved in film sound recording, the development of variable density recording as opposed to variable area, and that's something I wish you'd talk about. There may be people here who don't know much about the difference between those two and why both methods exist and so on. So what I would like to do is perhaps give Dr. Frain a chance to talk for, say, 15 or 20 minutes, whatever feels comfortable, about things that that are concerns of his, and then open the floor to questions from you, which can be handled in formal sort of back and forth discussion. Dr. Frain?
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I'm trying to remember not exactly the dates. When this thing all started was the Western Electric Engineering Department of AT&T, and then it became somewhere in the middle 1920s, and they had developed the electrical recording system for motion. For records and the electronic playback. That was done under a contract for the old Victor Talking Machine Company, and which later on was bought by RCA. That work was done in the Bell Labs, and Maxfield and Harrison published a very interesting paper about 1923. It's mentioned in here, in which they explained how they developed this cutter, known as, I think it was the 4/8, I'm not familiar with, if I've forgotten the exact number. And this was the first cutter the first damped cutter. You know, the old Edison cutter had a hairpin characteristic like this. It was undamped. Mm. And so this was a scheme for damping out the resonance of the filter. And this was the first instance of using electrical circuits, electric circuit analogy to mechanical circuits. No, they solved the electrical circuit first and then built the mechanical. Mm-hmm. That was done about 1924, something like that. And then, as I said, Victor was bought up by RCA, but they also took over the license which Victor had signed with the Bell System to go ahead with this electrical recording. And even until a few years ago, RCA, even though they had their own cutters, their own system of this recording, they kept on buying ours. Fiat kept on buying Western Electric, because they considered it much better than theirs. But it went back to the historic developed 24. Well, anyhow, the Bell Labs had developed this cutter, and so the next thing they wanted to do was get into motion pictures. And so they started developing a synchronized system using the disc method they had developed for Victor, tying it in with the motion picture projector, which was known as the universal bass. And there's some of those still around, probably in some of the old theaters. So there's a mechanical contrivance where the disc turntable was tied in with the projector, all mm-hmm. on the same base. And if you bought one of those stamps which commemorated the 30th anniversary of Talking Pictures. On that stamp, you'll see the picture of the Universal Base projector. Hmm. Did you buy any of those stamps?
You didn't. I've seen them.
You've seen them? Yeah. It's a very bad picture, but anyhow, the artist went to some theater and copied this, made a picture, made a drawing of this, of the old Universal Base projector. But anyhow, so in 1926, the Bell System was anxious to cash in on this research, and they tried to sell the idea of synchronized pictures to the motion picture industry as it existed at that time. And the big ones were, well, just like today, the big ones were Paramount, MGM, and Fox. I think Fox was big, but Universal was fairly big. Nobody would buy it, said this is a crazy idea, no one's interested. So they finally went to Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers were very poor, they were broke, they operated a rundown studio in Brooklyn. And they jumped at the chance, you see, because they couldn't lose anyhow. They were broke. So they smuggled one of the Warner Brothers into the Bell Lab, so they didn't want any of the motion picture people to see that we were going after Warners, because they might come in too. So they made a deal with Warners and the Western Electric or Bell Labs or both of them combined made some kind of a deal with Warners, which they lived to regret later on. It gave Warners the exclusive right for 30 years to use this system and use their own name, which they dubbed Vitaphone. See, it was all Western Electric equipment, of course, now. And there was also a provision in there that Warner Brothers had the right, and in fact they were supposed to, sublease this system to other studios, which didn't present any problem at the time because the others had all turned it down. So Warner's made this first musical picture in 1926 called Don Juan, the opera Don Juan, but all they made was the musical score, and that was done on disc. 33 and a third RPM, by the way. Mm-hmm. Which somebody else thought he had invented 20 years later. Our groove is a little bit bigger. 33 and a third of it. Because that was based on a 16-inch disc that had the same playing time as a 1,000-foot reel of film. Uh-huh. That was the reason for it, see? Yeah. Because in those days, the film was limited to 1,000 feet.
Was that the origin of the 16-inch disc? I mean,
yeah, it was
invented for that purpose,
yeah, that
and only
purpose.
Later
all,
applied to
all
radio.
Calculated based on that. Yeah. And it was instead of outside in, it was inside out.
Why was that? I've seen discs like that.
I can't think of the reason. I would draw some reason for it.
It seemed like a good idea.
Why did you record it? I don't have suction.
Yeah. I don't know what
the chips go in as the thing comes out.
Oh, is that it? It's purely
I guess there was some reason for it.
I see.
I've seen it myself, but that's why it was.
Save the start in the projection room as well. You couldn't make a mistake.
Well, I suppose that's true.
How so?
Have it miss cue when the projector started up.
Might be.
I guess that's true.
Could be.
Group speed was less.
Okay, well, anyhow, but now at the same time that the Bell System was developing and promoting this synchronized system, they were also developing a film photographic system. They weren't the only one. GE was in the same deal. They had what's called a palaphotophone, or the wobbling light phone. Mm-hmm. The Greek word for it.
Can you say that word again?
Palaphotophone.
Palaphotophone.
Mm-hmm. And DeForest was working on a system. And you all know about DeForest, don't you?
Yeah.
What did he do historically?
Vacuum tube.
He developed the vacuum tube.
Audio.
Accidentally, he didn't know what the hell he was doing. Really, he didn't know what he was doing.
It's like vulcanization of
and the, and the, and the and the AT&T paid him $1 million. That's a lot of money in those days for the rights to use it. And then they proceeded to develop and make it work, which happens in a lot of inventions. So anyway, we were developing, I shouldn't say we, because I've been out of there for so long. The Bell System were developing this system, photographic system. And they went for the variable density system because that was considered the only truly photographic system. Variable density recording follows the same rules and laws of physics as motion, as picture taking. You make a negative, make a print. If you expose the negative properly and print it, make the print properly, expose it right, you get a linear relationship between what you see on the print and what went into the negative. So basically that was the sound physical idea, photographic process. And Now, to do that, I had to develop a light modulator that was satisfactory for that purpose. So the developer was internationally and well known as the light valve, which was really what's called a 9th-Ohm string galvanometer, two of them vibrating with the plane parallel to the, or the plane is parallel, perpendicular to the direction of motion in the film. Perpendicular to the motion of the film. So what you got on the film was a film of constant width but varying density, as the ribbons opened in and out, you see. Mm-hmm. There were problems there, of course, a lot of problems, a lot of physics, and we can't go into that here.
It would vary the amount of light hitting the film as the film varied by, essentially.
Because it varied the distance on which the film had to travel through, that's how it exposed. That was called the variable time method of variable density. There's also a variable intensity method of variable density, which Fox had developed. We say it takes days for you to learn all that. So read the book. Well, anyhow, so... So Warner's made this picture, the jazz singer, which had by accident just a little bit of dialogue, mostly singing music, but unknown to Al Jolson, one of his talking was recorded, sort of bootlegged, and put into the picture, and Jolson didn't want it first. He didn't want to be, thought his voice didn't sound right. But actually, the little bit of talking in there was done surreptitiously on the stage. Because it was supposed to be limited to singing and to music. Well, that came out in 1927, late 27, early 28, and that was a big success, as you all know. And then the other studios, of course, all wanted to get in on the deal right away, because now they found out they could make money out of it. That always appeals to people, especially to the motion picture people. So the only people who had any equipment was Western Electric. RCA got into it belatedly, and GE had no equipment. We had the equipment, at least we thought we had. And so they all signed up. Now first of all, in our agreement with Warner Brothers, they were supposed to make the deal through Warner Brothers, have a sublease through Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers turned them down flat. Says, to hell with you. So we said, to hell with Warner Brothers. And we licensed all these people, meantime threw the thing under New York state laws into arbitration in the New York Court of Appeals, where it didn't come to a conclusion for about 10 years later, with sad results for us, good results for Warner Brothers. But in the meantime, all the other studios had been licensed. RCA got into the business by buying up their own studio, RKO. They went and bought this from whoever owned it at the time. And so that was our only entry into the motion picture field at that time. Disney came along. He was too poor. Financial department investigated Disney. Said, no, don't license him. He's broke. He has no
money. Well, now, by what year were most of the major motion picture companies licensed to use that system?
28.
By 28 already. Okay.
I think we had them all finished by. I think Universal was the last one. That was sometime in 29.
Now, did that completely wipe out the synchronized disc system immediately?
No, everybody, we kept, a lot of the theaters were only equipped for disc. Mm-hmm. See, in order to play the jazz singer, you had to have disc. There was no film, you see. Mm-hmm. So, and that was a cheaper system. You just bought disc only, you see. And they couldn't play film. They had the projector there, but they didn't have the sound head for film. So the... And a lot of the foreign countries, like in South America, most of them only had disc. So in order to project your pictures, you had to make it both ways. Mm-hmm. All the newer theaters had the film and disc, mm-hmm. which you got on the universal base. But some of the older ones didn't have. And I would say it must have been 30 to 31, something like that, that they stopped making pictures. They stopped making originals on disc very early, mm-hmm. except for playback purposes. Mm-hmm. Instant playback, mm-hmm. and they use the soft wax. You know, all the originals were cut on wax, soft wax.
What then motivated the variable area design? Was simply another way of doing it, or were there advantages to it?
Well, let me continue on for just a minute,
please.
In order to add your question, one of the first things I got interested in when I was joined their called ERPI in those years. Those the Electric Research Products was the subsidiary of Western Electric, formed specifically to develop motion pictures and sound recording of all sorts. One of the first things I got interested in, and I sort of fell into it by chance, was to extend the volume range on film. And my colleague Ray Scoville and I, he was one of my men working with me, we developed a noise reduction system. RCA called it ground noise reduction. And by using a system of closing down the light valve, space between the ribbons when there was no signal on there, then picking up the signal, rectifying and feeding in a rectified signal that opened up the ribbons as the signal increased, you see. In other words, we increased the modulation space. But so then you see, by closing down the ribbon, you got a very light exposure on the negative at that point. So when you print, you got a very dark exposure. And the noise on the film was reduced as the density of the print was increased.
I see.
So that was the first thing I did, was on noise reduction. One of my first patents was on that.
Huh. That's very nice.
And that extended the range about 10 dB. So brought up to 40 to 45. And then Eastman Kodak brought along finer grain negative, sound negatives. So combination of fine grain. You see, if you look at a photographic film, you know, it's the old silver films. It's all full of granules, you know, and pretty noisy. It produces noise when you scan with a fine beam. So by using the electronic, or you call it electronic noise reduction, which you superimpose on the signal, and finer grain film, we got it up to possibly 50 maximum. And of course, the film was good up to 15 or 20 kilohertz, but the modulating systems weren't there at the time, and the scanning systems in the theater were not there. Now, you mentioned about variable area. Now, a variable area is not really basically, you might call, a photographic system. It's more like an oscillograph, only it's not a oscillograph either. It's sort of a combination. You use a galvanometer of some sort, which rotates with the signal. And in variable area, it's really variable width. You vary the width of the track. But variable width is hard for anybody to say. It's much easier to say variable area. So the term variable area is stuck. And so in variable area, the track width, in variable density, the track width remains constant. The density of the film varies with the signal. Incidentally, I might mention one before we go on to that. Because of the nature of the photographic film, you cannot use, on the variable density system, the most you could ever, you don't have 100% range on a variable density film. You have about a maximum of about 50% due to, you get film distortion due to the characteristic of the film if you try and go beyond that. In other words, if you plot a curve of transmission of the print versus exposure to the negative, ideally you should have a straight line.
Right.
But it's only straight up to about 40 or 50%. But there it flattens out, you see. Mm-hmm. So variable area, on the other hand, you can make the black area almost as black as you can. The clear area as clear as the film can. So the limit on the modulation of variable area depends on how black the black area is, how clear the clear area is. And they were able to get up to 90% probably. So a variable area film for the same fader setting in the theater played louder than a variable density film by about 6 dB. This is one of the problems. The lazy projectionists didn't want to go down and turn that fader around.
By the way, one of the big problems that led to the end of the disc was shipping the wrong reels, shipping a disc.
That must have been fun.
Oh yeah, this
I
happened.
Can imagine
this,
some
this often happens.
Film
this
showings with the wrong soundtrack,
the wrong can in.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, shall we talk some about since we've slip back onto the subject of discs, talk a little bit about the Westrex 4545 system of stereo cutting and how that got started.
Well, of course, the Bell system and Western Electric had been in the disc business, I said, ever since 1922. So they kept improving things as they went along, kept improving the lateral cutter, had built feedback into it, took out a 30 dB peak. Can we talk about stereo for a moment?
Sure.
If you, I mean, this may be of interest to you historically. If you look in a dictionary, that was published before 1940, the word stereophonic will not be in that dictionary. It didn't exist. Did you know that? You find stereoscope, you find stereoscopy, stereoscope, but you won't find stereophonic. Now the original idea behind what's now called stereophonic sound, which is sort of a bastard thing, I guess. Harvey Fletcher, who was now retired, I think he's still Brigham Young University, he set up a department of acoustics in the physics department of Bell Labs about around World War I time, I think it was. And he's the one who wrote the book on speech and hearing, very famous book. In fact, he was the first physicist to be serious about sound since Helmholtz and Lord Rayleigh in the 19th century. Physicists got interested in electronics, atomic theory, gave up an old-fashioned thing like sound. They didn't pay attention. Mm-hmm. And Fletcher was the first, because the Bell system were far enough, they were in the telephone business, but they knew at that time they'd have to know more what's going on in the telephone system. Transmission of sound. So they started this basic research with no idea it'd ever pay off in anything particular. And Fletcher was put in charge of that. But Fletcher was interested in good music and interested in symphonies and that sort of thing. And as they went along and developed the better microphones and better transmission lines in the telephone system, he began the idea of, wouldn't it be wonderful since orchestras only appear in the big cities? Small cities can't afford them. Wouldn't it be well if we had a sound system, a sound transmission system, in which we could pick up an orchestra in Philadelphia, transmit it to Washington or Keokuk, Iowa, and reproduce in there exactly what you're hearing in New York? And that was the whole idea, reproduce exactly. So he called that acoustic perspective.
Auditory perspective.
Oh, and they called it acoustic perspective. Was the name he gave to the recording system.
Okay.
Acoustic perspective. See the book. It's all in there. I am. So that was the idea. And he never thought it would come to records like we're playing now or anything. So they began a system of studies. It's covered in the last chapter in the book, by the way. Briefly, if you want to read it more, read the Bell System Journal. But they began experimenting with the number and the kind of microphones and the placement of microphones you would have to have in order to reproduce on a distant stage or some other stage what the original listener heard in the original auditorium. And I can't go into all the details here, but they studied a three microphone. Of course, as he says in his own writings, the ideal thing would be an infinite number of microphones and an infinite number of loudspeakers in the proscenium, and then it would be exact. So since that wasn't practical, they studied a three mic system. Center mic, left and center, left and right, and they made all kinds of experiments as to, they had what's called a caller on a hidden stage with the three microphones, and he'd take various positions and he'd read something, and then they'd have three speakers set up behind a screen, and people in the auditorium sitting at various places judging where the speaker was based on what they heard. Mm-hmm. And they found that the three-channel system was pretty darn good, especially on lateral localization, and even good on depth localization. Then they studied a two-channel system. A two-channel system was pretty good on what we call angular localization, but very poor on depth localization. Hmm. And then in between was what they call two-and-a-half channels, where you had a phantom channel, where you tied two into a center channel.
So you'd use two microphones, but you'd use a left plus right speaker.
You could use three microphones and you could phantom them either
way,
end.
Right, okay.
So the conclusion was that three-channel system was the best system. But of course, Fletcher's dream never came true, about doing it. Incidentally, they had a tremendous presentation in Washington. In 1932, they transmitted the Philadelphia Harmonic, the three-channel system, three highly equalized telephone lines, and reproduced in Washington in the Daughters of the American Revolution building. They have a good auditorium there. Mm-hmm. And they played, this was all done live, see, played, of course there was no, couldn't record it in those days, but they had these lines especially especially quiet. They were hoping, Fletcher said you had to have an 80 dB volume range on an orchestra to really make it sound like anything.
Yeah.
So this was done in 32, and there's some stories about that. Stokowski, Fletcher picked Stokowski, at least later on he hadn't, because he couldn't handle the guy, but he picked him because Stokowski was experimental, see, mm-hmm. very few experimental.
Yes, that's true.
So Stokowski turned over the orchestra in Philadelphia to an assistant, and he went down to Washington to sit at the controls, see. And we know our engineers know he'd be fudging the controls, so they built an override panel in the basement. So when Stokowski would turn the dial, they would turn this the opposite way.
An old forerunner of the microphone that's put there just to keep the musician right. happy, I guess, right?
But it was a tremendous success. So then the next step for the Bell Labs now was to put it on film, you see, three-channel on film, which they proceeded to do. And incidentally, for this system, they developed marvelous speakers in those days. They had this big woofer. It went down to 16 cycles. Hmm. It had the diaphragm was a foot in diameter. You ever see one of those? About a foot in diameter, the diaphragm. And they had the woofer in the mid-range.
This was a horn woofer.
Oh, yeah. It was about 4 feet and a half square box at the edge. Tremendous thing. We call it the elephant's patootie. As none of our engineers did. Although I don't think the elephant quite could make his thing quite big. It was an inverse deal, you know, a folded deal.
When you were discussing the development of stereo motion picture film in the pre-World War II, that timing fit with what Disney was doing with Fantasia?
Oh, Fantasia? The people, Disney came, see, they were not licensees of ours, but Walt Disney came to our company and asked us, he'd heard about this stereo work we were doing back at the Bell Labs. In fact, I think he'd probably seen one of the demonstrations. And he wanted us to record sound for Fantasia. And we were all for doing it, but our bosses in New York thought, no, it's not quite ready yet, see, not perfected. We don't want to take a chance. Besides, Disney wasn't our licensee. So RCA jumped at the chance. They hadn't done any work on stereo. They just put in a lot of machines and recorded a lot of tracks. I think that's six recorders or something like that. And then it was all done in the dubbing, you see. It wasn't stereophonic. It was placement by...
Well,
it was volume, you know, placement by gain.
One of the first examples of multi-track recording.
Yeah, that's right. It was multi-track.
That's interesting.
They had
it
up in the ceiling and then back.
Very different from true stereo.
Yeah, and it had a control track, too.
Yeah.
You
know. What would the control track have on it?
It had some, yeah, some switching frequencies on there, yeah.
It was companding. The control track ran the companders.
No, he's talking about the Fantasound.
Yeah.
There wasn't any compander on Fantasound.
I think so.
I don't think so. It's always written in the book. But, so we turned it down, but then they decided to do some recording. The original recordings were all done back in Philadelphia. Then they decided to do some numbers out here, and... they asked us if we wanted to get in on it. We said, we'll go along and we'll make a duplicate track. So we did record like the Ave Maria number, which was one of the big numbers in the that was done out here, singing. We did record that, and Disney, I remember Disney coming over and listening to it. But with our agreement, they couldn't use it to use the RCA recording on it. Hmm. But we actually did record that number. I think we did... Is there a number called Night on Bald Mountain or something?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Sure.
We did that one too, I think. Did a couple of them.
Hmm.
And I think, you might know this, did we send a recording system down to Philadelphia in parallel with RCA?
For Fantasia?
Yeah.
Well, we were working there at the same time.
I think we did some, yeah.
They weren't using, they had one half of the room and we had the other.
Yeah, and we didn't do any of the actual recording then. I thought maybe we might have recorded something in parallel. Yeah. But we were offered that job to do that. So that, we made a big mistake because that would have given a tremendous boost to stereo sound and film.